Well, hello and welcome everyone to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on the zero emission future that we all hope for. And every week I get to be joined by one of the wonderful members of the EV Cafe team. And as often is the case, I have the lovely John Curtis. Welcome, John.
Yes, the lovely members weren't available, so here I am.
No. This is true. But every week we will have the amazing privilege of getting to know some of the pioneers, innovators, collaborators, and thought leaders in the space. And today we are joined by David Bartlett, Head of Accident Management for the AA. David, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So where in the country do we find us? Where we find you?
Does my accent not give it away? So,
I just wondered whether we would go down the accent route, but let's place you wherever you are.
Okay, so I live in Bristol in the UK, and despite my accent, I'm Welsh.
You're the second Welsh person we've had on, I think. Maybe even the third.
There are a few of us. We emigrated to this country when I was 3 years old.
Ah, fantastic.
So originally from where in Wales, David?
Newport, so about 12 miles away from Bristol.
Yeah.
Oh, so you just sort of swam across the water and stayed?
Pretty much, yes. Well, I think my mum probably carried me across.
So there we go.
I was only 3 when we moved.
Okay, cool. Well, David, listen, thank you so much for joining us today. We'd love to know a little bit about who you are and what you do.
So I'm Dave Bartlett. I'm Head of Accident Management for the AA. So I lead our B2B Accident Management division, where we provide our services to B2B customers, from vehicle fleets to leasing companies to fleet management companies.
Brilliant. So that will keep you busy then. How long have you been doing that?
So I've been with the AA just coming up on 16 years.
My goodness, that is a good chunk of time. They're obviously a good company to work for.
Yeah, very much so. Otherwise, I still wouldn't be here. the AA has given me a fantastic opportunity to develop our accident management business, and it's certainly something that is going really well. And as long as it's going well, I hope to still be here.
So for those of our listeners that sort of hearing accident management, I think we should elaborate, because it's not quite turning up on scene and helping us when we've hit the central reservation or the car in front or we've been shunted from behind. I guess there's a bit more to it. Tell us a little bit about what accident management in the AA looks like.
So I think that there is, of course, loads more to accident management. And I think sometimes the term accident management is overused. You have many companies who are in this industry who look to provide one component part, where at the AA, our accident management business is there to assist our customers from the point of collision, from the point of fire, theft, vandalism. It's there to assist them with capturing all the information surrounding the incident, passing that information over to insurance companies, arranging for the repair to their vehicle, and ultimately helping them settle any claims that they have that are associated with that accident. So kind of a real end-to-end service that we can provide our customers.
Fantastic.
David, is that service for your insurance customers, or is that for members? Who gets services that you provide?
So this tends to be for our B2B customers. So customers such as vehicle fleets, leasing companies, motor manufacturers, any essential B2B purchaser of our service. We do, of course, have solutions in the group that deal with members and our insurance companies, and insurance customers, I should say. Our customers tend to come to us through competitive market tender or through relationships that we've developed, perhaps on our roadside assistance business, that we identify and need to assist those customers when one of their drivers is involved in an insured event.
Oh, yeah. Now, you mentioned you've been in the business for 16 years. I would imagine that you might have seen a little bit of change in the fleet market over those years.
I think, yeah, very much so. Nowhere near as much as in the last couple of years.
What are the big changes? You know,
Well, certainly COVID has had a significant impact. You know, it's reduced the number of vehicles on the road. It has changed how we, in the B2B market, how we interact with our customers, how we interact with our suppliers. You know, the very reason we, you know, we're doing this over the internet today rather than face-to-face. Mm. I think, you know, that has become an accepted method of communication. I see probably more of my customers now virtually than I do physically. Mm. So, of course, what that means is that we have reduced reduced accidents, reduced incidents, because my vehicle, rather than being out and about, is parked up on my driveway. I think that translates to a lot of our customers.
And David, do people choose to be in accident management? Because I mean, I can see the benefits of it, right? How did you get here? Because, you know, did you just wake up one morning as you were leaving school and thinking, do you know what? I want to help people when they have an accident.
I left school when I was 16, so only a couple of years ago. And I was always inspired by my older brother, who was out there already earning money. And I thought to myself, how can I go and earn some money? And I went to the job centre on the guise of the job centre would give me free money. What I didn't realize is that I would also have to apply for a job. I applied for a job as a trainee motor claims negotiator, and I got the job. So I didn't get any free money from the job center. I got an income from an insurance company. And I think, you know, and I was only a young 18-year-old with a lot more hair at the time. Mm-hmm. And essentially, my career developed through insurance, through legal services, to corporate accident management.
Wow. And so what's kept you in accident management? Because I think you've been in it quite a few years now.
Yeah, I like the fact that we deliver an intangible service. You know, I'm not a salesperson who goes around with a boot full of stock to sell. Mm. What I have is I'm selling the expertise of a team, you know, the protection of a brand. I really like the idea that when a customer's involved in an incident, when it's a time of distress, emotion, confusion, that I lead a business that that has people that can help those people out. And that can simply be the case of just answering the phone to being able to provide them that all-encompassing solution, from, you know, taking that information that they've scribbled on the back of a cigarette packet, from repairing their vehicle to giving them a replacement vehicle whilst their vehicle's off the road. And then, if they haven't been at fault for the accident, helping them recover the costs of the accident. So for me, that's kind of a driving factor, because ultimately everything we do is about helping people. And I really do like that. I know that sounds probably a bit salesy, but I really like the idea that with an intangible product, you know, we can really deliver such a positive outcome for customers.
And that pleasure in helping people, where does that come from? I mean, you know, because I think often points to some experience in our lives where it felt good to help somebody, or you got helped in a similar situation, maybe as you were younger or growing up. But, you know, was there any point at which your life kind of took a turn where that would help?
Absolutely. You know, when I mentioned I started at that insurance company, and this was, you know, a long time ago, where perhaps some companies weren't as friendly as they are now, that staff inductions don't take place in the manner in which they do now. Mm. And I started in this insurance company, and I started you know, I was so young and I was so naive. And at the time, I had a manager who didn't want to be labelled, lumbered with, you know, the 16-year-old spotty teenager who's there to learn a profession. And I found myself, I spent all my time stood by his desk, you know, essentially asking for help. And that help wasn't forthcoming. And I always remember saying to myself that if I ever find myself in a position as a leader, as a manager, and someone asked me for help, I'm always going to help. I think it really grained on me. And when I was so young, you know, I can't believe I stayed at that company, because you're young and you're stupid, and, you know, if something goes wrong, you just walk out the door. But I stayed and I learned, and it was kind of like, in some respects, like a pledge I made to myself that if anybody ever needs help, I'm going to help them. Mm.
And you've stuck to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Yes, yeah. On the weekends, I have a cape.
And you wear your pants on the outside.
Absolutely.
But it's a yellow cape. I'm sure of it. I can just see you now with high vis and everything. Just like this one. There you go. There's mine.
Absolutely. It really has stuck with me. And to translate that into my team, into our customers, has surely... what makes my life a lot better.
You wrote an article recently, which we've all seen for Fleet News, which was the end of the road for the courtesy car, which is interesting because essentially what it says, I think, is that the changing world where we have increased costs and pressure on resources and pressure on the real estate that we have, the buildings, the infrastructure we have, it's really put a pressure on repairers who are now struggling to give that level of service that, because I'm old, I remember getting a courtesy car when my car was in for repair. Hmm. And you comment at length about the changing dynamics of this market. Do you think that repairers are giving as good a service now as they always have? Or has it changed for the worst?
I think the dynamic has certainly shifted between organizations who refer work to repairers to, I think that dynamic has shifted. You know, five years ago, if we experienced poor service from a repairer, we could, you know, you could be as drastic just to terminate that relationship. Mm. But now you have to spend more time focusing on how you remedy that relationship, how you work better together. And I think it's that dynamic shift that has changed. I think most repairers do strive, of course, to deliver an excellent service. And, you know, we spend a lot of time and we invest heavily in terms of how we work and collaborate with repairers, because often, you know, they are the coalface who deal with our customer and our customer's driver.
Mm. And that's the thing you focus on. You focus on that a lot, David. You focus on... we don't do this. We don't do courtesy cars as much as we used to. But actually, your article is very much focused in what solutions you do provide for this changing world.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think one of the things I did with that article is I wanted to use it as a media to communicate with a wider market, to say that there things that we expect, things that we have accepted as the standard, are no longer readily available. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't courtesy cars available, but what it does mean is that when you're dealing with a customer who has an accident, then there's a lot more communication and management of expectations.
Mm. And David, within that market, we know that there is an increasing number of challenges, not least of all, of course, cost. Is it becoming trickier to manage the expectations of people because the costs have gone up, the parts are taking longer, the repairs taking longer, all of these things? What is it about that whole mix that has become so challenging?
So, you know, one thing that we've always tried to be is transparent in our communications with our customers. I think it's very easy to simply assume that a customer who's had an accident will go through a sausage machine process. But instead, what we have done is we've identified kind of the pain points and the pressure points in that whole repair process, and therefore built those elements into our customer communication. So when I have a customer who is reporting an accident to us, we will manage their expectations from that outset, surrounding if they have a requirement for a replacement vehicle, how's that going to be accommodated? And I think that's some of the things that I've talked in the article surrounding is how, you know, what are the things that we can do rather than simply accepting that a courtesy car is going to be available.
Mm. So what are the things that you're most proud of, David? Because, you know, you have innovated and you do find new ways of delivering good service. What are you most proud of having delivered in your time with the AA?
So I'm really proud that, you know, when I joined the AA, AA Accident Management was essentially a department that existed to service our own substantial vehicle fleet and the odd legacy customer. I'm particularly proud in leading the business to grow the customer base significantly, but also develop our people. You know, when we talk, you know, we just mentioned the challenges of dealing with repairs in the current climate. I'm really proud of the resilience of my team. You know, historically, you know, we would give them a monthly communication to say, you know, this is going on or this is going on. Now we're on kind of regular daily touch points to say, this is where we stand. These are the challenges that we experience in this area. And this is how we're going to combat them today. Mm. And I think, remember, we're going to combat those differently tomorrow. So I'm incredibly proud that of the resilience of my team.
It's a word that comes up a lot in podcasts that we have, and it's that word resilience. And it's great. I mean, I think COVID kind of brought some degree of resilience to us. But as a leader, I guess there are points in your life where before today, before COVID happened, before all this sort of tricky, these big changes and all of that kind of stuff, what has brought about resilience in your life?
So I think on a personal basis, I think from in my family, you know, we've had a lot of bereavements in my family. You know, I've got a 2-year-old, and my 2-year-old has got no grandparents. You know, and that brings challenges, and I think that you have to do things differently, and you have to be resilient. And one of the things I like doing is I like running. Now, I know I don't look athletic, but one thing I'm striving to complete is something called the World Marathon Majors. Now,
this sounds challenging.
It is, and like I said, it's not. So there's 6 World Marathon Majors, and I've currently completed 4 of them. Now, I can't stress enough,
wow.
I'm not at the front of the race as an elite athlete. I'm at the back of the race with people dressed as stormtroopers and carrying fridges. But but I think one of the things that running a marathon teaches you is, for me, is resilience. It's where you learn every aspect of yourselves, from, you know, that excitement, anxiety at the start, and I'm going to run fast, I'm going to run my fastest mile, to when you get to that mile 20, mile 21, and you think, the world's going to end, how do I have the mental strength to keep going on? And I think that for me, that's on a personal level, that's kind of areas where I test my own resilience, my own mental resilience.
Yeah.
I did the marathon in the last millennium, let's put it that way. I did the London Marathon, and I'll never forget being at 21 miles and being passed by 4 rhinos.
Okay.
And that, as you say, that's the moment where you find out who you truly are. Am I going to give up, or am I going to catch those rhinos and beat them? And I dug deep, and you have to, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I ran London Marathon this year for the first time. It took me 10 goes on the ballot to get through. And there was a point at a similar time at 22 miles that I came up on somebody who was carrying a fridge. I ran alongside of them with this kind of mental fortitude of, I'm not going to be beaten by somebody carrying a fridge. And it dawned on me that this person was, in fact, had been in front of me for the first 20 miles.
So what in that moment, David, what is it that you're able to draw on that brings you that resilience? I mean, is it a dogged determination learned through training and things that then you're able to adapt into business, or is it other experiences? I mean, you talk of your bereavements, and sort of digging deep in those moments. Is there a bigger picture at play in when you're running the marathon?
Yeah, I think, you know, people do lots of different techniques to get them through the tricky miles. I tend to I'll kind of segregate things into sections. So I'll think about, what have I got to do next week? And I kind of visualize, I need to respond to this, I need to call this person. And then there's kind of this, people talk about a technique where you're supposed to select a family member and think about them for a mile. I think it's kind of whatever it takes to distract your mind, and hopefully that finish line approaching.
It's the pain you go through to get to that finish line. I remember looking at every lamppost and thinking, I've just got to get to that next lamppost. Once I'd done that, okay, I need to get to that signpost. And you just keep extending the distance you can run. And some days it was as hard as that. You know, I can only run another 100 yards and I'm going to fall down. But you, somehow you do it. And it's an incredible thing that you've done. Did you run for a charity?
So London, I didn't. I ran, so there's six World Marathon Majors and I've run four of them. So I ran New York for a charity for linked to a family bereavement that we had. And I ran Berlin for prostate cancer. So my dad passed away from prostate cancer. So I ran for Prostate Cancer UK there.
Good man.
And I've got two left. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get into them, but we'll see.
What have you got left?
So I have Tokyo and Boston left to do.
Wow.
So of the six, so I've done New York, Chicago, Berlin and London, and I've just got Tokyo and Boston to do.
So if the organisers of the Tokyo and Boston Marathon do happen to listen to this, and we will tag them into this.
Absolutely.
Please give this man a go. He needs to do his six marathons.
Especially Boston. Boston has a qualifying time based upon your age. And I think the only time I could travel that fast is if I fell out of a plane. So if they are listening, I would very much appreciate space.
Do you find your sense of humour works well for you, David, in the workplace? Because you're clearly a very humorous person. Does that help bond a team and bring people together for you? Or are you a different person?
I'd like to say that my sense of humour does. I'm not too sure if it's probably to everybody's taste. My team are based predominantly in Cheadle in Manchester, so we have a lot of talk surrounding the North and South divide. You know, naturally, being a Southern softie, I'd lose most arguments, but I quite like how, you know, that kind of Northern side translates to our service delivery, because, you know, it's about communicating. It's about sometimes delivering bad news. Whereas I think sometimes down south we have the tendency to over-explain and over-analyze and not actually get to the point. And I think certainly with my team, I'm always really appreciative when they're just brutally blunt with me.
David, you spoke earlier, obviously, about the completing of the marathons and setting these targets. And we've spoken a lot about what you are doing currently within that business world. But what does success really look like for you over the coming months and years? And I would give it, you know, both personally and in the workplace within the AA.
I think personally, naturally, I want to complete the marathons. I think also personally, it's, you know, I want to be happy. You know, I saw something.
It's not unreasonable.
No, I saw, you know, someone recently asked, you know, what is happiness? And I had a brilliant definition, which they said happiness is about enjoying the passing of time. And I think if I can strive that, then that's got to be fantastic in my personal life. I think from a professional element, I naturally want to see further growth in AA accident management. I think we are at a really exciting time for the AA. You know, if you take AA accident management is part of the wider AA. Now, if I'm stood in front of a customer and I can say to that customer that I can assist you with your insurance, with your roadside assistance, with your accident management and your risk management, I can truly give that end-to-end incident management experience for our customer base. And I think we're at a really exciting time with the right drive and strategic purpose to make that total offering available to our B2B customer base.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
You mentioned, David, your family as being important to you, and obviously having had bereavements is difficult and something that we all sadly carry with us. In terms of business, who's been your biggest influence? Is there somebody that really sticks in your mind as having helped to shape you?
Yeah. So I mentioned that insurer where I first started and how my team manager at the time was disinterested. But at that time, I was really fortunate that we had two claims handlers based within the insurer from something called the MIB, which is the Motor Insurance Bureau. Mm-hmm. And these two older gentlemen, Brian Nicholson, John Bishop, they're probably not with us anymore because this is many years ago. They kind of saw that I wasn't getting the support I needed as a young person, and they took me under their wing. Mm. And I would truly say in my career, I have never learned as much as what I learned from those two individuals over the sort of 2-3 years. And I think that kind of translated itself then into as my career developed.
And presumably you then mentor others in the same way?
I kind of I have a personal mission, which is, you know, I'll never refuse to help. Mm. It's because I know what it feels like. And I know at that time, it would have pushed me to the point that I could have just left the business.
Yeah.
And I think that even the simplest little thing that you can look at the individual asking the question and think, you know, why are you asking that? You should know that. Just take the time. And I think that's really important for me.
Brilliant. There's in your article, David, you talk a little bit, and of course, as the EV Cafe, we focus to some degree on, on quite a large degree, on the transition to zero emission. And your article reflects on the changes that are happening and things like that. How do you see the world of sustainability and the advent of electric vehicles? How important is that to you and obviously to the business, the AA? How do you see that influencing your role today?
I think the AA has got kind of a responsibility to create confidence for drivers, both kind of now and for the future. But I think with a real kind of clear strategic vision that, you know, driving shouldn't cost the earth. You know, personally, I've transitioned myself to an EV. And so
how are you finding that?
Yeah, so I'm, 6 months in. I don't suffer with the anxieties that some people have. I don't suffer with range anxiety. Mm. But I probably suffer with a little bit of service station anxiety.
Yeah, no, that feeling. And,
but I think, you know, we see more and more customers with their vehicle fleets. You know, the number of EVs that exist, you know, for much higher penetration and kind of grown on a month by month basis. So we've had to make sure that we can still continue to service the needs of an EV when dealing with our accident management.
Mm. And do you see that the EV navigating those channels differently? Does it, I mean, because I guess there's a limited amount of repairers. The repair is reportedly to take longer for an electric vehicle. I mean, is that true or is that just anecdotal evidence? What is that?
It is true. Repairing an EV versus an ICE is more expensive. And there can be a longer repair duration for repairing an EV. Now, but in the same context, if you offset that with the greater level of technology that are in EV vehicles that will actually help reduce collisions. Mm-hmm. If you translate that more to how it benefits our customers with their own kind of ESG commitments, that has a value.
Yeah.
And I think that value has to be translated back into a procurement decision to award the business. But I think, you know, very similar to how we talk about courtesy cars and how you manage customer expectations, there is some management of expectations that you have to do with customers when dealing with an EV vehicle. And it can be simple things from, you know, how the vehicle has to be brought into the repairers, how it's stored at the repairers, and sometimes the number of repairers that can be involved in the actual repair of the vehicle. Mm. Now, that can go smoothly if you have an organization who is transparent in the communication with the customers, but also looks at that customer's vehicle fleet. I think sometimes we can be guilty in this industry of just taking a fleet list from a customer, uploading it into a system, and then when a driver reports the claim, that's the first time we know what type of vehicles that customer has on their fleet. You know, we've taken it a step back and said, okay, well, when we secure the customer, when we implement that customer, when we do account management, let's have a look at their vehicle portfolio. Let's see how it's changing. Let's see where the geography of these vehicles are to make sure that we have repairers who both have the capacity and the capability to actually repair the vehicles. Because if you have that, when it comes to, when a driver is reporting a claim in a time of need, you've got that EV repairer there ready to repair the vehicle.
So it sounds like then that whilst we are going through this change, the demands on us as suppliers, in your context, the of accident management and breakdown services and other things that the AA we all know and love about, have got to do their due diligence to be ahead of the customer in terms of supporting them in that that respect.
Absolutely. You know, it's when collaboration more than ever is required when you're dealing with that customer. You know, it's. And I can joke and say it gives you one more thing to talk about when you do an account management meeting. But it is really looking about how that customer's fleet is evolving, you know, and how to make sure that you are communicating with that customer and working collaboratively so that, as I say, when you allocate their vehicle to a repairer, you're actually allocating it to a repairer who is there and has got that capability and capacity. Because if you don't know that information and just kind of deal with everything reactively, you're going to fail.
Yeah. No, I think that's one thing that I've seen as we've looked out at the industry is that need to share from each other's experiences, from each other's journeys. Because there's so many, I mean, charging is a great one, sure. Right? Lots of companies have tackled charging or haven't tackled charging or have just gone off and bought a load of vehicles on the mandate from the CEO or a dictate from an MD or a win of a tender that says they've got to deliver them in electric vehicles and then gone, oh, how are we going to put energy in them?
Absolutely.
and they're sitting idle. So it's great to hear that you guys have really thought about
it. Take it, you know, that step further and say, you know, that data is essentially our superpower, you know, to do something right. More with it than just rather than just hold this information on a spreadsheet. Look at it and do something meaningful with it. Do something consultative with it, because that surely has to translate to a better customer outcome when they call upon the services you need. Now, I feel as if I should go next slide on the PowerPoint now, but but I think, you know, as I said from the outset, you know, when you're involved in an accident or a fire or theft or vandalism, it's emotive, it's confusing. And I think you can be scared by some of the technology that you have in your own vehicle. You know, having the confidence that you can deal with a competent partner which says, do you know, I've got this. I want the customer to say, you know, thank God I'm with the AA.
Absolutely. Now, absolutely. One of the things that the AA have done so brilliantly over the years, Dave, is they've improved road safety without question. And you talked about data and the data that you have, which is your superpower. What's the data telling you about how we can make our roads even safer going forward? So smart motorways, for instance, Edmund King, the president of the AA,
absolutely.
Has long talked about the damage that smart motorways were doing and killing people, and he's been instrumental in getting a change of government policy. What do you see as the next big thing that the AA can help campaign to improve road safety with?
I think it's... You have to look, you know, particularly in the world of EVs. You know, what the data that you get from EV accidents are still in its infancy. You know, what does that mean to a customer? What are the different behaviors that are needed when you're involved in an accident in an EV? The different safety concerns that people need to be concerned with. And I think, you know, one thing that we've done in the AA is we've taken that data from our accident management business, and I pass it to my colleagues in AA Drive Tech. Now, these are far greater minds than mine in terms of analyzing that data, analyzing those patterns and those trends, and then translating that to meaningful customer outlooks. I think you spoke to one of my colleagues, in fact, Anthony, recently from Drive Tech. Anthony being a great example of being in a business that takes all of that data from areas in the AA and translates it to customer solutions, customer products, but also that messaging, such as what Edmund has done with smart motorways.
All right. So let's say that you've got a magic wand and, you know, you paint a picture of the AA as being the most wonderful place to work. And we know from the inside that it actually is, but there must be frustrations. There must be things that you wish, I wish I could do something about that. What would your magic wand be used to do?
Well, I'd love to wave that wand at perhaps procurement people within the B2B market. And that's probably controversial to say.
And so say all of us.
And I mean in the sense of, you know, if you send a tender out for, let's say, an accident management service, and you're trying to evaluate this the service on one figure, you know, what's your vehicle repair labor rate, then you're going to fail. You have to look at, you know, what is their repair to replace methodology? What are their strategies for reducing vehicle downtime, controlling costs, giving customers cost certainty? I think those are more important than whoever has the cheapest labor rate wins the business. That's my biggest message to anybody working in procurement in that industry, is focus on everything apart from the vehicle labor rate, because that's where you'll identify a better provider who is a perfect match for what you're looking for.
Yeah, it's not about cost, it's about value.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thanks, Dave.
We always talk, I've got three key messages for our accident management business. You know, we give our customers cost control, cost certainty, and we reduce their vehicle downtime.
What more do you want?
That was a brilliant summary. I like that. Give me that one more time.
We give our customers cost control, we give them cost certainty, and we'll reduce their vehicle downtime.
Reduce their downtime. See, there is that ending or reducing of downtime is so valuable. So valuable. Well, David, listen, it's been really cracking to get and understand everything about the AA and the accident management, and particularly about you and about how you bring that desire to help to so many, both individuals within your business, but vicariously through so many customers that get, I know, big word,
it's
right?
Good.
Vicariously. I actually think it means through other people, but
we'll
I'm not sure. I'm just pretending. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Dave. David actually knows what it means. Yeah, that's good. But yeah, so bringing that through to so many other people, and thank you for sharing a little of your journey with us. That key of resilience, cost control, cost uncertainty, reduce your downtime.
Absolutely.
The AA, managing your accidents.
Absolutely.
He is available for voiceovers and bar mitzvahs.
We'll take that soundbite and use that. Thank you.
There you go. David, have you got any final thoughts that you'd love to leave us all with?
No.
Apart from those wonderful three
thanks
points.
Thanks for the opportunity to share a little bit about myself, but also about the AA and its accident management business.
We're going to get you in the marathons, my friend. We are getting you in those marathons. Good on you.
Hashtag Boston Marathon.
Yes,
please.
You got it.
Hashtag Boston. He doesn't want to be dropped out of a plane to meet your time. Please, please. Hear from David Bartlett from the AA. It's good value.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, listen, everybody, thank you so much for joining us for this wonderful insight into the accident management service that the AA provide and how they're adapting for electric vehicles and also making sure that they're ready for all of these changes. So, John, David, thank you so much for joining us today. And we look forward to the next time where we get to talk more about our wonderful industry and its innovators, pioneers, collaborators, and thought leaders. Thanks for the article, David. And I encourage anybody, it's on Fleet News. Go and check out Fleet News, The Death of the Courtesy Car. But also go and check out AA's website for accident management services. And I'm sure that David and his team will be happy to help. But in the meantime, have a great day, everybody, and we look forward to catching up with you next time.